Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I am Chef Thierry Rotiro, the chef in hats.
And you look fabulous. Marvelous.
So do you, Tom.
We are here, you know, we're kind of doing our show on a little different day here at the Hot Stove Society, and so we have a much smaller audience, so they're going to have to clap really hard to make it sound like the full meal deal. All right.
That's awesome.
Good job, team. We have a large show today. I'm chef owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including Lola right downstairs from here, the Carlisle Room up by the Paramount Theater, Palace Kitchen, and, of course, Dahlia Lounge is celebrating its 30th anniversary on November the 15th.
Congratulations,
Very exciting.
Tom.
Yeah, exactly.
There's not many we can claim to that in Seattle, Washington.
I know. One of my team, we were having a little chat about, you know, some of the celebrations we're going to do, and the team said, well, what is your plan from year 30 to year 40? And it's like, you know, I didn't really think about it like that.
You guys really think I'm going to stick around for another 10 years at least?
So anyway, so that was it was fun to chat about it with the team a little bit and get some celebrations in order.
And I am the proud owner of Luc in Madison Valley and the Lule downtown Seattle at the bottom of the Sheraton Grand, 6th and Union.
We are having a coconut cream pie giveaway.
Ooh.
From the, I want to say it's the 7th to the 15th or something like that. Originally, we were going to do a special on all the restaurants, so $6 for a slice, like almost half price.
Wow.
And then my marketing director, she said to me, she says, you know, $6 for a piece of pie doesn't seem like much of a deal. I said, well, it's normally like $11 or $12.
She says, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. $6, not enough. So then I had to go free, and I'm going free at the Dahlia with a purchase of like a couple of entrees or something
like that. Oh, good for you. That's awesome.
It's going to be fun. Today on the show, we have pro tips for the home chef. We have a dinner party that we're going to use pumpkin in every course because one of my jobs, you know, one of the difficult things about my work is that, you know, when you think about what pie, this year's pumpkin pie for the Dahlia Bakery, you have to taste them all.
Yeah,
and
that
so
is.
So this morning for breakfast, I sat down and I put a frown on and I had a delicious gingerbread crusted piece of pumpkin pie with a ginger butter cookie on top.
So you turned that frown upside down.
And vanilla whipped cream. And just thought to myself, God, this is a tough job to have to taste test all this stuff.
So did you turn the frown upside down?
I did.
Okay, good.
It was fantastic. So our pie is picked for the Thanksgiving rush next month. Brittany Bartleben joins us in the Baker's Corner. Chef Terry and I played a little fun game last week about how well we know each other. And we did pretty good for a while. And then we kind of fell off the rails. So we're going to wrap that up a bit. Our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge is going to wrap up the show. You don't want to miss a bit. We're here for 2 hours. If you don't see us or hear us live, you can get us on a podcast at your favorite place that you get those. Ordinary to Extraordinary, Chef.
Yeah.
You are extraordinary.
And so are you.
Oh.
Every week.
So I guess it's all things all pumpkin today. So pumpkin seeds, pepitas, so to speak. I like the ones that are commercially grown. I'm not a huge fan of the ones that you scrape out of the Halloween pumpkin and
no,
roast.
You can have those. I've tried those.
Yeah,
and
that's a lot of roughage.
It's never been very successful on my part. I mean, there are plenty of things to eat on this planet, and if it doesn't have to be painful, I'd like to stick to that.
Yeah.
I think eating fresh pumpkin with the seeds in there, it can be some serious challenges because it can be really big seeds and very, very crunchy. And
have you ever tried deep frying them?
No, but I've roasted them many, many times, which is probably the most common way that people make it. I like to roast them, and I also like to put them on things like goat cheese toast. You know, if you're making something with a cheese base, like a soft cheese, it's nice to put pumpkin seeds on it. It creates some nice texture, nice, just like a crustini wood underneath. It's nice with cold meats. If you do, like, for example, smoked duck, you make like a small duck crustini with, let's say, olive tapenade. You know, I'm a big fan of olives. And then put ground. You take the pepitas and you ground them. Basically put them in your food processor, ground them, and then sprinkle that on top of your meat. It creates an extra texture, an extra flavor, and I think it's a nice finish to your dishes.
You're back talking about the more commercial pumpkin seeds, the ones typically sold for salads.
I'm doing commercial,
You've walked away from the Halloween pumpkin seeds.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I do a lot of good things in my life, and I think pumpkin seeds go straight into the compost bin. It's a great place for it.
All right.
It allows the compost pile to grow pumpkin next year.
Yeah. Get volunteers.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And then for the guts, when you're scraping out a jack-o'-lantern pumpkin, you don't want to save the guts. You just throw them away. Be happy.
I like to compost
Think
that.
About all the scary faces you can make for the kids.
Yeah, it makes good compost. Yeah. Good compost. Okay. And, just use a big spoon and scrape that really nicely. But I also like to cook pumpkins, just so we're clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this country, we used to make jack-o'-lantern with pumpkins. But where I come from, we grew pumpkin to eat.
Yeah.
And pumpkin.
Well, different kind of pumpkin.
A nice pumpkin. Yeah, well, it's the same kind of round, soccer size ball size, you know. Mm-hmm. And we used to cut those in pieces and just roast them. Or actually, when I was a kid, we used to boil them and make a nice soup with that. And it's a nice base. It's not any different than a butternut squash soup or anything like this. And it makes a really beautiful soup, especially finished with a nice dollop of creme fraiche on top.
Sure, why not?
And if you can afford it, a little caviar on top of that is actually delicious.
What what kind of candy are you giving away for Halloween this year?
I don't give candies away very often. My wife
does,
though.
What do you give, like a little pâté en croûte?
No, I don't give anything
away.
Here,
let's go to this house. He's got some duck liver pâté.
You know what? My wife put a bowl of candy for probably, 20 years, for as long as I can remember, outside our door. And there's no kids in my neighborhood for some reason. They just don't come up the stairs.
You know, you're getting the Scrooge on pretty early, aren't you?
We get a house that says...
At my house, we give away full-size candy bars. Like either from the Seattle Chocolate Halloween bar, you know, they cost me like $3 a piece or something.
Wow.
But again, only one kid comes to my house. So it's worth it.
See,
you know what I got? You don't
come in my house.
Yeah. My house, the adults come because I give away mini bottles of liquor.
Yeah, exactly.
So I put out a little tray and it's got Jack Daniels or Maker's Mark or tequila or something. And half the time, they'll just take the bottle and move on, say, thank you, sir. The other half the time, they literally just twist the lid off and shoot it right in front of their kids. And I have to have one with them, of course.
Yes.
Because, they're my neighbors.
It makes Halloween a great night.
By the time Halloween evening is over, I am completely soused, and I can't even... It's also my anniversary, and so, it's over.
Yeah. Thank God you don't celebrate on that night.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Up next, we're going to do a Halloween-themed dinner party using chocolate in every course. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Hey, it's the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's a pumpkin dinner party. No. Cinderella and the pumpkin is coming to our house with all the leftover chocolates from the trek around the neighborhood. And we've got to use some chocolate in our dinner party.
Man, I tell you
one
thing.
I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in hat. Tom, if we were to melt all the chocolate that comes right from Halloween, it wouldn't be that good. That chocolate is not that good.
You don't think the chocolate that people give away is a good chocolate?
In most cases, no, it's not.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So Reese's cups are the biggest one. What's wrong with a Reese's cup? You are a bit snobbish.
Maybe I am.
Have you ever had a Reese's cup?
Yes.
Okay. And what did you do when you ate it?
I thought that was a lot of sugar and lots of... it's a candy. It's good. It's not... Reese's cup is fine. I mean,
okay.
It's a candy. What do you want from a candy?
Well, I'm just... I've had lousy
Mars bars. I've had, just a few of those candies. Mm-hmm. I've tried them, and quite honestly, it's not that great. I mean, if you melt that down, and it wouldn't be that fabulous of a chocolate to use.
Okay. So I'm going to move on from there.
Okay.
And I'm going to start our dinner party with a guest.
Oh, it's going to be...
Fran Bigelow.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because Fran is the chocolate queen here in Seattle.
Is.
So
she is.
I'm going to have Fran come, and we're going to get started because it's kind of a twist in our weather anyway. We have moved definitely into fall.
Yep.
And it's time for something like a Brandy Alexander
which is
a little creme de cacao.
Ooh.
Right? A little brandy, a little cream, and that is just going to be the most delicious beginning with... I don't know what to do with Fran's chocolates. I mean, we should probably use one of her bars. So I'm going to take her gold bar, which is like a chocolate almond caramel bar, and I'm going to take bits of it, and we're going to put it into a savory shortbread with a little lavender blossom and some of that almond caramel. and a little savory shortbread to go with our Brandy Alexander.
Dang, that's a great start.
It's pretty good. I think Fran's happy.
I'm thinking I'm going to make a...
Have you been to her Georgetown factory?
Yes. Oh, what a beautiful, spectacular place.
Yeah.
No, we need to talk more about that place, as a matter of fact. For all of you listeners out there, it is worth taking a trip down to Soto and... Or is it Georgetown?
Georgetown.
And the old Renew Brewery down there, mm-hmm. where Fran has a laboratory. It is a work of art.
Yes.
Absolutely, everyone should go and visit. And because I think it is, you know, it's not often looked upon, but it's the best chocolate place we have in this town.
Oh, for sure.
In terms of...
Certainly world class.
Yeah, world class. And I think it should be visited much more than... I don't know how much
it is. It's pretty busy whenever I've been there.
It is actually always busy too when I go.
I have to wait in line, yeah.
But it should be visited and it should be put on the map of things to do in Seattle to visit for sure. I'm going to make the appetizer. I'll start with the smoked duck breast rub with cocoa nibs and a little cayenne, a little salt, mm-hmm. and then cure those duck breasts overnight. And then clean up a little bit of that rub the next day. Put it in a smoker, low, low, low heat, like 80 to 90 degrees for about an hour. So give it a very light smoke. And then slice that puppy up. Actually, I'm going to put it in the oven for about 30 minutes just to finish to cook it.
Uh-huh.
Very low, low heat. And then it's going to be cooked medium rare to medium. Actually, medium, not medium rare. And cut it off, slice it very thin on the plate. And make a nice little salad to go with that. Probably this time of year I would do a little bit of beets, a little bit of mushroom, raw mushroom, white mushroom, button mm-hmm. mushroom, sliced super thin, salt, olive oil. Let it sit on the counter for about an hour so it softens down a little bit. Mm-hmm. Put that with your beets and put that with your smoked duck breast.
Maybe a little bit
of olive oil, a little bit of frisée, mm-hmm. of course, or watercress.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, nice little salad to start.
I love that. That made me hungry, Chef.
Yeah, well.
For me, we're going to jump to a whole other country.
Ah.
And we're going to have a little mole.
Oh.
And mole, we're going mole. To grind some of that ancient kind of Inca chocolate or Aztec chocolate. You know, that stuff that's very...
Yeah.
It's not super fine like you see in the modern chocolate. It's got a little crumb to it. Or Mexican chocolate.
I have some in my cupboard.
Yeah, always. When you can make your Mexican hot chocolate or, you know. I don't know if it does or not, but it always tastes to me like it might have a little cinnamon in it, or it might have a little some other flavorings besides chocolate. So we're going to make our mole with that, and pumpkin seeds, and pecans, roasted toasted pecans, and cashews, and lots of different nuts, and some dried cherries, and we're going to make it, cook it down to a paste, and that's going to be our mole to go with a what?
Venison.
Venison. You think that would be good after duck? We'll have a little game dinner.
Well, you have to stay up. You can't go from duck to veal or mm-hmm. anything like that. So you have to go a little bit up. So, yeah, I think venison or maybe deer or, you know.
That's the same thing. Venison and deer, same thing.
Well, one is it exactly the same thing?
Yes, it is.
Somebody wants to Google that up and call him down.
No, of course it is. Venison and deer are the same thing. We could go elk chops.
Elk chops, yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be good.
With our mole. Yeah, and then just a little bit of... roasted cauliflower or something like that now, or roasted pumpkin, a little caramelized pumpkin with that, you know, be super good. And then, you know, I understand that Fran loves elk.
I'm sure she does.
I have no idea.
Fran, if you're listening to this, I hope you like elk. Because that's what you're getting for dinner. And for dessert, of course.
When was the last time you served an elk chop? I don't know that I ever have.
Less than a year ago.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know that I ever have. I've served venison before, but...
Yeah. For dessert, obviously, a nice little bittersweet chocolate tart.
Mm-hmm.
Very simply done. Tart shell, pâte brisée, blind bake. Put the chocolate, which is melted with a little bit of butter, light amount of honey, and then mix the whole thing together and put it in the bottom of a tart shell. And... orange.
Uh-huh.
I like orange and chocolate this time of year. It's a very nice combination. Confit some slices of orange in a little bit of syrup or sugar. Put them right on top of those little tartlets. And then make an orange and chocolate mm-hmm. tart. And a little whipped cream on the side, vanilla whipped cream. And I think you'll have a wonderful little dessert on your hand.
Should we be watching the movie, like, what is it called? Like Water for Chocolate or something?
Yeah.
What's the name of that? Maybe we should have that on in the
what
background.
What was her name? The Canadian actress. Is it Canadian actress?
I don't know. And then music.
I think what's his name? Oh my God! He did an album with Lady Gaga.
Oh yeah, Tony Bennett.
Tony Bennett.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm.
I think Tony Bennett for that dinner would be most. I think Fran would appreciate that.
Really? You're saying Fran's old? What are you saying?
No, I just think she would appreciate that. Or maybe
I don't think she would appreciate that.
Or maybe some good Vivaldi, you know, some good.
Yeah.
The Four Seasons.
She seems like more of a class.
Yeah, classic.
Class act.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, that was dinner. That was Halloween dinner.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, Halloween is my 36th wedding anniversary.
Ooh, congratulations.
So maybe I'll make that dinner for Jackie.
Here we go.
But she doesn't care for chocolate. So we'll use a problem.
We'll use turnips instead.
Yeah, exactly. We'll do turnips and beets. Mm, that sounds delicious. Turn up the beet.
Oh!
Sean, our producer, is on fire today. It's time to move on, Chef Terry. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, we're okay.
It's time for pro tips.
Absolutely.
Right here in the Hot Stove Society, because that's what we do here. We teach people the pro tips when they come to class here.
We help them.
We help them.
I don't know if we teach them, but we help them.
We try to teach them.
Yeah.
All right, that's what's coming up next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I am Chef Thierry Roturo, the chef in hats.
Tina, do you want to jump on the mic here? And Tina is our producer here at Large Media. And let's talk about these pro tips that you put down here.
You know, the pro tips.
Are you looking for like us to agree or disagree, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, you know, I think people love to hear pro tips when they're and things that they can incorporate in their home cooking. Mm-hmm. And you guys are the experts in these types of things. And I scoured around the internet looking for some. I found some on a blog called kitchen.com. And what was interesting to me about this article was that it is from someone who has worked in, from Charlie Norwalk, who's worked in kitchens all mm-hmm. over the place. And he's got some tips that are specific that he learned from professional kitchens. And I thought I'd run them by you and see if these are things that you incorporate. Or are they things that you would recommend people actually incorporate
okay.
into their home cooking? The first one is, when slicing soft or slippery items like cheese or raw bacon, pop them in the freezer first. He said, a quick 10 minutes or so is usually long enough, but it makes it easier for manage those slippery items. Too much trouble?
I don't think of cheese being a freezer item, but when you're doing carpaccio, like you're taking a raw beef loin
yeah.
and you want to do that, then yeah, giving it a quick freeze.
Butter for when you make your dough. Mm. I would definitely put it in the freezer before you grate it. And, you know, it allows for a better spread, better grate. And also, you can never achieve the same thing just by cubing it and mixing it in your hand because it melts before you, or it starts softening down. So by putting it in the freezer, you allow your butter to be super hard, and then you grate it right into your flour, and you don't have to do as much mixing, and it allows the dough to be not so elastic.
That's a great pro tip. All right, I liked this one. Use sizzle platters instead of sheet pans. Now, I didn't know what sizzle platters were, but they're the small oval-shaped metal pans that you use in restaurant kitchens. Mm-hmm. And this seems like a handy tip. They're small, easy to manage.
Sometimes, you know, cast iron-like or pewter-like.
Yeah. 100% with him, but...
Do you use them at home or only?
I use both because a sheet pan I use when I have more items than I cannot fit on a small oval plate. Those plates are great for individual portion. Mm-hmm. Let's say you have a piece of salmon and you want to finish it in the oven. You put it onto that plate and you put the plate in the oven. Or you put it under the broiler if you want to do a little gratiné or whatever. But it's not very practical if you do 10 pieces of salmon.
Yeah, it's much more practical in a restaurant environment.
Correct.
Or if you're cooking for two. So, for example, how I use a sizzle platter, I've cooked a whole roasted chicken or a whole roasted duck, right? And it's all ready to go. Now I bone it out, and now I want to heat it up, and I want a crispy skin before I put it on the table, yeah. right? So I'll take my sizzle platter. While I'm boning out the chicken, I'll take my sizzle platter, put it on my burner at mm-hmm. low to medium, get it nice and hot. Then when I'm done butchering the chicken, I put the skin side down on the sizzle platter and let it just sit there and get dark brown and crispy. And then I serve it. So now I got a nice crusty chicken right before. Mm-hmm. But if you make a roasted chicken and let it sit out to rest like you're supposed to do, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then you cut it, and then you are trying to serve it, you have a soggy skin. It's just the moisture of the chicken mm-hmm. has come back through that skin, and you now have a soggy skin. Mm-hmm. So this is a way to kind of rehash things right before you serve it.
Yeah, it seems like it's also good for quickly toasting nuts and things like that.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a handy thing to have around.
Yeah, if you have, well, a pan works fine for toasting nuts, any of that sort of thing. I think they are easy to take a scrubby to, but they're not really for that sort of scenario. But if you have a trivet, you know what a trivet is?
Yeah.
Like a little piece of wood or something that you can put on your tabletop. Now you take that same sizzle platter, you put it on your burner and turn it on high, mm-hmm. and then, like down at Lola, what I do is I take a little mix of green onions, yellow onions, lemon zest, I just a little bit of olive oil, and I put that on my burning hot sizzle platter so they go whoosh, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I put my kebabs on top of that, and then I hit the whole thing at the table with some ouzo, and the whole thing goes crazy, bubbly, steamy, yeah. You know, and it just makes a great show. And that's really, from a sizzle platter perspective, it's an awesome way to kind of engage your guest at the table.
I love that pro tip.
And that's how I lost my eyebrows, because I actually like that ouzo on fire.
Is that a true story?
I'm just kidding.
They're back, chef. I'm just going to tell you, they're back.
So they grew back.
All right. He also says, go for a good chinois instead of a strainer.
So
cone-shaped strainer with a fine mesh instead of a regular strainer.
I agree that both are useful. I think I have both of them in my kitchen, and I think they both have a different usage. If I'm, for example... Sometimes putting through a chinois is great for fine straining. You know, if you have a chinois is a conic metal
a cone piece, shaped, yeah.
cone shaped mesh,
yeah,
fine mesh, and it's great to strain bouillons or liquids or to actually make sauce and then strain them through that. If you're doing, for example, little florets of cauliflower, for example, then you've blanched or things that are a little bit more touchy. If you drop them in a chinois, and if you have a lot of it, it might actually crush them a little bit too much. So the basket strainer is actually a little bit better for that. More space, better weight. What do you think, Tom?
I agree. I think a chinois is fun to have for sauces.
Yeah.
I don't really see it for much else. It's not like you can press...
Correct.
You press potatoes through it for mashed potatoes, or you can't do much else with it other than fine strain.
All right. So yes or no. Is it worth having it at home?
No.
Okay.
I would say for the typical home kitchen, no.
All right. To perfectly slice chives and scallions, wrap them in a damp paper towel to hold them together.
After they're chopped?
No, as a whole thing.
To perfectly slice
That's just
chives.
A waste of time and waste of paper.
All right. Not a pro tip,
Enjoy
Charlie.
The shade of a tree rather than do that.
All right. He also says, always have a pair of chopsticks around, especially for brunch. To have chopsticks at home all the time?
I have chopsticks always, but for brunch, I'm not sure that's necessarily where
Do you want me to eat my cinnamon roll with a chopstick? Or
yeah, what is it?
He's saying that chopsticks are especially helpful during brunch service when you need to quickly crank out hundreds of scrambled eggs. Wooden chopsticks don't scratch nonstick pans.
No.
So they're handy to have when you're...
Yeah. I'm not sure.
I would say you only see Asian chefs that do that. It's because it's a more natural thing for them, and they grew up with it.
Yeah. No. All right.
I would definitely not mix scrambled eggs very well with chopstick.
Oh, seems weird. Okay, how about season your food during every step of the cooking process?
I'm a no. I know a lot of chefs are, yes.
You need to definitely season at the end. Verification of seasoning always at the end. So
not during the whole process for you,
Well,
chef.
It depends on what you're doing. Depends on what processing we're talking about. If you're making a stew or something that's going to cook for a long time, I would suggest you just lightly season at the beginning for the pieces of meat, not season the vegetable, and then re-season at the end.
All right, but so disagreeing with Charlie on that one.
I just think it just adds to the tremendous oversalting of food that many chefs do naturally.
Yep.
And as you taste throughout that process... Of course, you need more salt to taste through the last salt, and it just builds and builds and builds. And that's why food is so salty at so many restaurants.
Yeah, I find that with pepper, too. It's either too spicy, sometimes too spicy, or sometimes too salty. Okay.
But here's what I will say. It's like when you're using fresh herbs, you know, seasoning isn't just salt and pepper. When you're using fresh herbs or fresh garlic, I like, say, in a beef stew, I like to put some herbs and garlic in at the beginning, mm-hmm. and then I will refresh those. So now you have a certain type of herb flavor, a cooked herb flavor, and then at the end I'll add the same herbs raw, and so now I have that fresh bouquet at the end,
right.
So you have a combination of layers.
Great idea.
All right, what about this one? Sear as the last step of cooking if you're cooking for a crowd. Makes things easier and quicker.
Let's say you have 10 people over and you're having chicken breast. Mm-hmm. And it's a boneless but skin on with a little wingtip, right?
Yeah.
And so what essentially they're saying is that you're going to bake all those off until they're done. And then right before you serve them, you're going to put them in a pan and sear them. Now, I find that you could do that, but I don't think
personally,
it's
Personally, yeah, I would get all that done ahead of time. And if you really need to warm up your chicken because you've cooked it in, you know, 30 minutes or an hour before, I would slice it in big slices, fan it on the plate, flash it in the oven for about 2 minutes at 350 degrees, and your chicken is plenty warm. It has not cooked again. It's just warmed up. Mm-hmm. So now it's ready to serve. And that's the best advice I would give somebody in terms of thinking ahead and getting ready for a party of 8 or 10 people, especially like things like Thanksgiving. You know, rest your turkey. Let it sit really nicely for about an hour. Let it sit. Carve it up. Slice it. Put it on a big platter. And then flash it in the oven for 2 minutes. Everybody's happy.
Just not so that the, not long enough that the tray gets hot and you can't pass it around the
Correct.
Table.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
On the same topic of searing, he says preheat your pan for properly searing your meat.
Of course.
Correct. That, yeah. That is very, very, very important. I think it's a step that I always see people at home. They're afraid of heat. They're
and
afraid.
Don't overcrowd your pan.
Yeah.
It's a big one. You end up stewing if you overcrowd your pan.
All right. He's got a tip for making soup. He says, make flavorful soup with shrimp and lobster shells, not meat.
That's when you do need a chinois at home. That's the perfect spot for a chinois. And you take the shells and you saute them, maybe with some vegetables, you know, it's like typical for a bisque. And you take the shells, you cook them up, and then you put them in a blender or a food processor and get it all as smooth as you can. And then you work it through a chinois to get rid of all those shells and leave everything else. And that's the base for a nice shrimp bisque, crab bisque, lobster bisque. That is a classic en français
recipe. As a good trick, I would say break the shell before you start. Put them in a bowl and use your pastry pin or whatever you have.
You're going to take the meat out before you start, right?
Yeah, take the meat out, but break the shell down in small pieces so it won't clutter. Because the bigger the shells in your pot, the more water you have to put to cover them up and to make the stock. Where if you break them down in smaller pieces, you don't have to put as much water and you have a better concentration of flavor. So that would be my advice. And don't overcook it. Whatever shellfish, if you use shrimp shell or lobster shell, after you start putting your stock up, your boiling water, your boiling stock, do not cook for more than 30 minutes. After 30 minutes, you're done. You don't get any more flavor. You're just accentuating cooking the part that you don't really want to cook. So just 30-minute boiling. Strain that through a chinois or even a fine cloth so you have no impurity left into, no pieces left into the stock. And then put it back into a stainless steel pot and then cook it slowly down. You know, cook it down at least 1/4 or 1/3 down so you're evaporating some of the liquid and you're concentrating the flavor. That's it.
Yeah, that's classic. It is much more difficult to get the shells and sediment through a linen cloth or through even cheesecloth than it is a regular strainer or a fine chinois strainer.
Right, I would say.
Because you're really pressing against it, right?
Right, right.
All right, that's all the time we have for pro tips. Maybe we'll bring that subject back in a week or two. Coming up, a look at what's happening in the world of Washington east of the mountains from Hightower Winery on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show, and we're going to take a time out and head over to Red Mountain, just east of Yakima, maybe 60 miles east of Yakima, down there on Highway 82. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in the hat.
And Tina, you were on the road.
I was. My friend Angela and I got in the car and headed a little east to the Red Mountain AVA. And we had such a good time. We got to taste wine via horseback, and I had a lovely dinner with a bunch of the winemakers over there. I'll be bringing some of those interviews to you in the coming weeks. The first one, though, I want to share is a conversation I had with the Hightowers over at Hightower Winery and Vineyard. They are unique because they are a husband and wife co-winemaking duo. And, you know, you'd think it'd be difficult to make wine as a married couple, but the Hightowers have really figured it out.
We have the same different palates, but the same goals for making the wine. So we didn't have the same goal. There was no way we could make the same wine.
And respect for the other person's palate. You know, because you can't say, well, no, mine, I'm tasting this correctly and you are not. You know, you got to figure it out. And it's a long process, but it's really fun. And
So what's that like? Are you're halfway through or midway through something that's aging, and you each are tasting it, and you're like, well, I think we should do this, or I think we should do that. And you have to come to some type of consensus on
well,
that?
I mean,
like,
we try to
a really stupid question.
No, not at all. I mean, different winemakers go about things different ways, and when they blend and when they don't. We started off blending very near to when we bottle, so, you know, 18 months after it's been harvested, just because in the very beginning we didn't have experience with how things would develop, and we wanted to see how this vineyard or this block or this varietal would develop. So we have continued doing that. So Kelly and I go through and taste every barrel in the winery over a period of days.
Sounds fun.
But we make notes on it all, and there's some streaming that goes on just from harvest about, you know, we know certain clones, certain parts of the vineyard, and like certain types of barrels that we know from experience go well together. And so we sort of stream that for like, oh, you know, this kind of stuff will probably maybe be end up in the reserve, or this will be more Merlot, or you know, the oak regimes and things you have to pick. But we don't make any final decisions until, 18 months later when we're bottling or preparing for bottling. And we put mock blends together and then try them blind versus, because if you know your favorite barrels in blend B, you tend to pick it even if it's not the best, as we discovered. So then it's just like we'll pick one winner out of the three, and then we'll try to get, make two new contenders to try to better it.
Even if we both say this is the best of these three,
and we love it,
we'll still continue to.
Can we make it better?
Better, yeah. And
so usually it's about 9 to 12 iterations, and then we decide, and then those barrels come off the table, and then we have the rest of the barrels to work on the next blend. So we start with the reserve.
Fun.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And tiebreaker is just the next blend.
Yes.
Everybody asks about tiebreaker.
We have to agree that that's the one. Yeah.
What makes Red Mountain the spot for Cabernet?
Well, there's actually several factors that kind of contribute to making it the perfect spot for growing Cabernet. So one is the interesting one is the wind. It helps keep the berries very small and the skins thick. And that's what red wines get their flavor, and particularly Cabernet is a smaller grape anyway. So it tends to be a bigger wine because there's more skin to juice ratio. And so with the thicker skins and the smaller berries, good things come in small packages, right? So that the wind contributes to making the berries small and the skins thick.
So there's low organic matter in the soil. So growing grapes is kind of contrary to what most people think about for growing crops. Mm-hmm. You want the vine to struggle some, so you don't get a huge canopy, because if you get that, you get green flavors in the grapes, and you want the sort of ripeness and things. So low organic matter keeps the canopy small, keeps small berry size again. The wind, we can control the water here, which is something that's not unique in the world, but compared to some of the other major, you know, best grape-growing, cab-sauv-growing regions in the world, because we're a semi-arid desert, we get about 6 inches of annual precipitation. Most of that falls outside the growing season. So we can turn the water on and off with irrigation. So we get the Lake Missoula floods. There was this ice dam in Montana that backed up all this water into what's now where the city of Missoula is located 15,000 years ago. And these ice dams would float up and release these walls of water that would come all the way across northern Idaho, eastern Washington, and all the way down to Oregon, and deposit these soils in repeated repeated floods, and then over the years the wind has blown and moved that stuff around a little bit, and that's what sort of settled in here. But there was these eddies that came, hit the backside of Red Mountain, and as the water came around, it eddied and dropped soils, and then that was then picked up by the wind and redeposited.
So what are you looking forward to, and what can wine drinkers look forward to in the coming year?
We have been enjoying Cabernet Francs. We just made our first varietal Cab Franc. We've been using it as a blending grape for many years, but we've never, from our vineyard, we've never made a varietal Cab Franc. So we're interested to see what this weather does to it this year, and
it's always, I mean, we started off with Cabernet Sauvignon as one of our favorites, and so it's always just interesting to see what, maybe it's geeky for us, but what the variation this year will bring.
And
that, is it sort of a surprise? There's some things that you can predict, right? But there's probably a lot that happens in the barrel that
there's a lot of you can look at the vines and the grapes and taste them, but then the full expression of it, you know, you don't really know until months later.
Yeah.
I mean, you can tell things as you go along, but...
Yeah, and that's what I think, you know, so much of winemaking is really, it's about the site, it's about the vintage and the weather during the year, but... blending is where we get to put our, you know,
magic.
Our contribution is how we put the blends together. And I mean, you have to pay attention during
fermentation. But besides blending, I mean, we've tried to be pretty non-interventionist winemakers. I mean, there's.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you can
manipulate.
Manipulate things more by processing or adding things or. Enzymes and other things, and we don't do that. We do add yeast. We add SO2. We give a little yeast food, but then we're truly trying to show the expression of the vintage each year. So we're trying to show what the best of the vintage can be, as opposed to trying to make something taste the same, you know, year after year after year.
Yeah, that attention to detail and the unique way that they look at wine really shows in the delicious wines that I tasted over at Hightower. A big thank you to Tim and Kelly Hightower for hosting me and letting me taste some of their really delicious wines. We sat outside looking over their vineyards. You can visit them too if you head over to Red Mountain AVA. I highly recommend it. Right now is the time to go. It's the end of harvest, and as you drive east from, you know, Western Washington, wherever you live, those fall colors are really outrageous this time of year, and the wines are just delicious. So head over to Red Mountain AVA, visit some of my friends, the Hightowers or Hedges Winery. Plenty of places to go to enjoy a weekend getaway from right here in Seattle or Tacoma or wherever you're listening.
Well, that was super interesting. I hope you had a blast.
Wonderful time. Delightful. I will go back again and again.
It is a beautiful part of the world.
When the sun is right, the mountains are, or the hills are golden.
Yeah.
This time of year, it is spectacular, and there's lots of fun things to do over there.
All right, questions from our listeners. That's you on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Yay! We're back here at the Hot Stove Society. And it is an exciting day because we get to talk to Brittany Bartleben in the Baker's Corner. I always enjoy having her come over from the Dahlia Bakery. We're going to talk about baking with kids. Baking kids?
No, baking with kids.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm seriously sure.
Because it is Halloween time, and there's some scary stuff that we can produce. We're going to find out what Chef Terry and I know about each other, having known each other now for 30 years or so. We're going to find out if we really do know each other.
If you haven't heard last week, beginning of this segment... you should definitely podcast it and listen to it because it's. I think it was pretty good. I like it. I like the fact that we actually know about each other.
And then we have questions from you, our listeners. And if we use your questions today, your name will go in a hat to get one of the new signed aprons that we have, our Seattle Kitchen Radio Show aprons. We'll put your name in a hat if we use your question, and then pick one out at the end of the show and send you a signed Seattle Kitchen Show apron. It's very highly prized. And just have to say.
There's only a few in the words.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, we're going to follow up with our Tasty Trivia Challenge. But first, questions from you, our listeners. Tina, what you got for us?
You know what's great about our Facebook page is that it's very active. I went on only last night and said, hey, do you have any questions for Tom or Terry? And it's all filled up with all kinds of culinary quandaries.
What was that
for
noise?
The two of you. That's what it sounded like. You probably heard it in your sleep last night. All right, your first question comes from Elliot Bangs. She's asking about oil. She says, I have used oil and or butter. How can I flip eggs to make an omelet, and what temperature do I use when using oil and butter?
You just have to melt the butter. You don't need to get it hot. You don't need to get it brown.
Yeah.
You just have to get it melted and so that it's just starting to bubble a little bit. And then I would pour my eggs in, and if I'm making an omelet, I just make sure that I kind of float my spatula under the eggs and start to work it around the omelet. Or if you like it more Jacques Pepin style, you can put a whisk in there and stir it up and make it more custardy. That's what
I make my omelet, yeah.
Your famous eggs, your
scrambled egg.
Scrambled egg,
yeah.
Also.
My sister loves those because they're soft scramble.
Yeah. So, and that's how you do that. And you could use oil or butter. I would suggest butter.
I would suggest
or
butter
if you're going to use oil, use olive oil. But a neutral oil there doesn't make sense to me.
And if you go in a bistro in Paris, very often you'll get a brown butter omelette, which is basically they melt the butter a little bit longer. So it's blonde kind of color instead of white for me. Then they drop the egg, and that colors the egg on the outside. They will roll it at the end. You know, they let it cook, and they move it a little bit in the pan. Then they roll it gently, and then it comes at a half moon shape on your plate. Mm-hmm.
Delicious. All right, Liz Clark says, preserving fresh herbs before they are gone. How do I dry? Should I dry or freeze them in ice cubes or oil cubes? Any thoughts
so
on
there is many ways.
Preserving
if you have herbs. A lot of herbs. I mean, if you just have, you know, my thumb size of chives left, I wouldn't worry about it. I would just fold them in, put them in the freezer. Next time you make a soup or a stock, throw them in there, and you'll have extra flavor.
They'll be black, though.
They will be black, but it doesn't matter. It's still an onion. It still will have a little flavor.
Yeah, like basil turns black. And
correct.
Mint turns black.
It's no big deal. It's just you can put that in a soup or into a stock.
You know, I have this giant rosemary bush in front of my house, and I love it very much. I walk by it. It smells so fragrant. And so I like to just clip it. But I should just... Should I dry some, or should I just always use the fresh?
You shouldn't touch it because rosemary stays around all year round in this town, so I wouldn't worry about it. I would just leave it as is.
Yeah. But all the others, things like thyme, oregano, you can just put some strings around the bunch. What I like about drying them is that it's pretty.
Yeah.
You hang them in your windowsill, you know, across your window.
Yeah. And it smells good.
Lavender or lilac or whatever it is that you're cooking with. But the ice cubes are certainly an easy way to go, and it's better for, like, if you're making pesto.
Right.
Go ahead and make the whole pesto with the lemon juice, with the nuts. Some people don't like to put cheese in and freeze it. I don't mind it. Then you just pull it out and put it in your pasta when you've got hot pasta.
And then the oil infusion is the same thing. Bring the oil to about 80 degrees and drop in your herbs in there. Put the whole thing in the blender, and now you have an infused oil that you put in a very thick cloth. Let it drain overnight, and you'll have all your beautiful oil-flavored basil oil or whatever if you have a lot of it. It's
lovely.
Always a great thing to do with chives, tarragon, basil. All those herbs are going to die in the next week or so if they're not. Well, basil is already dead, but those herbs. So.
All right. This is a question from Susie Scott. What is the difference between dried pastas? Sometimes they taste okay. Other times they just taste stale or flavorless.
So the difference is timing. I mean, if they taste stale, is because they've been made for a long time and they've been drying out and not dry properly, and they just basically aged like any normal thing, which is now it's stale because it went rancid.
It is an interesting question, though, as you're at the grocery store and you're standing in the aisle. And, I mean, a noodle is a noodle is a noodle to me.
No. There's egg noodles. There's durum wheat noodles. There's fresh pasta.
Sure, but...
And they all have they all have a date stamp on it.
But the brand, like, is it brand over brand?
There's not as much difference.
Like, you're going for a regular penne.
A Berea next to a DiCecco or next to this or that. I don't think there's a whole lot difference.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the makers would argue with me.
Right.
Because there's some that are double and triple the price.
Yeah.
That are more more handmade, maybe, or something of that. But pasta's pretty simple stuff. It's wheat and water. And sometimes you can get stuff with eggs in it, and that is a different kind of pasta,
right,
I would naturally have more flavor. You know, when we did our Hot Stove Society tasting panel on pasta, do you remember which one came out first in the taste test? Chef, do you remember?
No, but I remember that it was surprising. It was not the egg pasta.
It was the gluten-free pasta.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Because it had different flours in it, right? Yeah. It had corn flour in it, and I think rice flour. It was
more flavor.
Yeah. So that was interesting. But, it's pretty simple stuff.
All right. We have a whole bunch more questions, but we'll have to answer them on next week's show.
So, Abigail, why don't you pick out a name of who wins our radio show apron with signed by Terry and I?
I think I'm going to pick Susie Scott.
Hey.
Yay.
All right. Susie, if you Facebook us your address, we'll send it off to you. All right. Up next, we're going to play a little game of how well do lovers know each other.
There we go.
That's between Chef Tom and Chef Terry.
Mm-hmm.
On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We're back in the Seattle kitchen. It's Tom Douglas, Terry Rotereau, the chef from the chapeau. We're here at the Hot Stove Society, and it's time to play our game amongst lovers. So, Abigail, you came up with this little game based on a TV show that you think is fairly new, don't you?
No, well, I haven't seen the original ever.
Oh, the original. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like, I've only seen it.
From 50 years ago original?
I've seen it on the internet.
Oh,
so.
Okay. You know, that's how my wife and I got married. It's the newlywed game, right?
Oh, really?
No, just kidding.
Well, I'm a little bit disappointed, but...
Tell us about this new segment you dreamed up.
So basically, it's a game where you find out how much you know about each other, and we ask you a question, and you're going to guess what the other person's answer is. And if you get it right, you get a point. And you get eternal glory forever.
Eternal glory
forever.
Yeah,
so there's
okay,
a bunch
darling,
of
I feel like
this.
I know you very well.
Yeah, I feel like I know you too.
We're going to find out who's the better friend today.
Oh.
Because it's a competition.
Okay.
Oh, of course.
As all friendships are.
Okay.
So let's start with Chef Terry.
Yes.
What do you think Chef Terry's favorite food city is?
Favorite food city in the whole world?
Yes.
I would say... Lyon, because it's a classic food city. I'm sure he's gone to very many fine restaurants in Paris, but Lyon is the home of French cuisine with Monsieur Paul Bocuse.
So you're right on the fact that Lyon is the capital of the food of the world, probably. Mm-hmm. That's what they call it, at least. I would guess that my favorite city would probably be Hanoi, Vietnam. I've been to Vietnam 2 years ago, and I was... definitely blown away. And if I have one city to pick as a city to go eat, and I've been in a lot of them, I would say also that I wasn't raised in a city, so to me cities have been something that came up as I grew up. So I would say that my favorite city is probably Hanoi, Vietnam.
Hanoi, Vietnam. He's only been there once, and
only
now
once.
It's his favorite food city in the world.
It is.
How's a guy supposed to know?
But no,
I'm sorry, you're incorrect, though.
Yes.
That's how the game works.
All right.
What do you think Chef Tom's favorite city is for food?
San Francisco, California, and Seattle, Washington. Those are the two cities I picked for him.
Really?
Yeah.
No. Alba in northern Italy.
I did think about
it. It's the home of... white truffles and beautiful pasta and Barbaresco and all the kind of simple foods that make me a fan of food.
Mostly Barbaresco.
Mostly Barbaresco. Or that little dryish kind of Piedmontese hazelnut cake that I love with a shot of espresso. Mm.
That sounds delicious.
Sounds delicious, yeah.
All right, so...
And I have been there more than once. Like maybe 20 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so we've got zeros all across the board right now.
Okay, thank you, Abigail.
All right, let's move on. Do you have any kitchen pet peeves is the next question. So let's start with Chef Terry. What pet peeves does Chef Terry have in the kitchen?
Pet peeves? He doesn't love music in the kitchen. He doesn't let his cooks listen to music when they're working. At least that's the way it used to be. And I love... distractions in the kitchen. Like when I was on the line, I would have the baseball game on the TV, music on the radio, and then I would just, because I spent a lot of time there. Believe me, you spend a lot of time in the kitchen when you're the chef on the line. So that would be my guess is one of his pet peeves. There's plenty, I'm sure, but it would be music on the line.
I would guess that when I'm at work, you're right on, Tom.
I'm right on, Tom.
When I'm at work, I don't like distraction. I like my cooks to be focused, and I like them to be... I think it's a very big distraction to have music, and I've caught my employee being on watching their phone and watching a baseball game, and I'm like, what are you doing? I'm just watching the game, and I'm like, you're watching the game while you're using a knife, fire, and you're supposed to be working. Not so cool. I don't agree with that.
Okay, there you go.
All right, and what do you think Chef Tom's pet peeve in the kitchen is?
Fussiness. He hates fussiness. As you just heard, he likes to watch baseball, listen to music, and cook at the same time. Obviously, chaos is part of his life. No, but I mean, I think he hates anything that's too tight and fancy or fussy.
I would say it's generally true. For example, as Chef grew up in his career, he loved making stocks and then reducing them down,
yes.
Cooking them for hours and hours, reducing them down into these very intense, fussy, finished sauces. And I am much different in my approach. Like, I didn't really make stock unless I was making a soup. I liked things like a piece of grilled salmon rather than in a fish fumet. I preferred it in a charred apricot and jalapeno puree or something, you know, just a fresh sauce. And so that's a very different style, but that is true. So he is correct.
Yeah, well, we've got one and one now, neck and neck. This one is a more difficult one to get, so I'm curious to see if we get it. What is Chef Terry's most memorable cooking moment in the kitchen?
Well, for him cooking or in his food moment in his life?
I'd say him cooking.
For him cooking, that's a tough one because, you know, he travels the world, and I would say one of the most memorable ones, at least it's memorable to me, is when he was on Master Chef and that he got what was considered a ringer item in a croque monsieur or croque madame, and it turns out he choked on his croque and got eliminated from the show. To me, that would be a most memorable...
That would be your most memorable funny item on me.
True or not true?
True for you, not true for me. Most memorable moment would be Julia Child dinner at Rovers that we did, I don't remember how many years ago, probably 15, 20 years ago now. And Jean-Louis Paladin's release of his cookbook at the time. Jean-Louis Paladin was a chef at the Watergate Hotel, and a very fun guy, but very, very good chef. And those two people were probably highlights of cooking in terms of my career, in terms of great moments. Cooking for Julia Child was extremely special, especially being from France, coming here and learning about Julia Child. And really, I really admire this woman. She's tremendous.
Well, she's arguably brought French food to the American table.
Yeah.
What about Chef Tom? What's his favorite cooking moment or most memorable?
I would think then we'd have to go and dig back a little bit. I would think then Tom would probably have his best moment, probably making food for Obama or something of that nature. Probably. Oh.
Well, that's certainly one. Getting the phone call from Mr. Obama after I put a coconut cream pie in his limousine because he didn't have time to eat it, so I ran it out to his limo and put it in the back, and then I got a call from him, left a voicemail saying, dude, that coconut cream pie is over the top.
Did he say so, dude?
Yeah, he said dude.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Anyway, I think for me, it's, Terry wouldn't know this, but back at the Hotel DuPont where I had my first real cooking job, it was a hotel where you could cook, you know, in hotels they have the employee cafeteria all the way up to the finest dining room, right?
Sure.
And as a young cook, I didn't know that they even existed in that way. And so I had my job, and then I had the opportunity, there was a fine dinner happening that the chef was actually making, and I volunteered my time to work that, and it was like $200 a couple or something at that time, and that's 42 years ago.
Which is huge.
Huge. And so... when I saw the food that was going out there, it actually opened my eyes to what food fine dining was. And that's a super memorable thing for me to actually have that experience at such a young age. I was 17, 18 years old, so it was super fun.
Well, I've decided the winner is both of you because we've grown closer as friends.
Thank
that
you,
is so lame. That is so lame. Both of you.
But Chef Terry did technically get a half point for Obama's one.
For Obama's one, exactly.
Yeah, so.
He's the winner. You get eternal what?
Eternal glory.
Eternal glory
eternal
to you,
glory.
Chef Terry.
I guess we're going to have to do that again one more time, some other time.
All right, it's time for the Baker's Corner, coming up with Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
We're happy to have Brittany Bartleben join us from the Dahlia Bakery and the Dahlia Lounge. You're also going to stay for our tasty trivia challenge,
yep.
Huh? Because you're a very competitive person.
I'm very competitive.
Man, is she competitive.
Yeah, makes my day when I wipe the floor with you two.
Whoa!
But every time I talk trash, I lose, so we'll see.
Yeah, I think you just set yourself up right
exactly.
there, girl.
I set myself up real nice for whatever.
Let's talk pumpkin desserts.
Let's talk pumpkin desserts.
Because, you know, the winter squash is all harvested at Prosser mm-hmm. Farm, our farm. I think we have enough for about 1,000 pumpkin pies, which have started to show up in the bakery.
Yep.
This week I had a slice this morning at Seatown for breakfast. Super good. I loved that the shell was pre-baked, that it has the little gingerbread base in it. I want to know how to do that because it doesn't feel like a crumb to me. It feels more like a paste.
Yes.
So I don't know if you know. I know that's Stacy's pie, right?
Yes.
Is that the one in our bakery book?
It is not.
Okay, yeah.
No, we switched that up the next year.
The next year.
Yeah.
And then the different squashes you can use for the pie. Mm-hmm. And then other pumpkin desserts because pumpkin bread has become very popular. Pumpkin spice is ridiculous everywhere.
Yeah.
But pumpkin cupcakes, there's lots of things to do with pumpkin. But let's talk about the pie first as people start to imagine their Thanksgiving selection.
Well, let's start with what you said. You said winter squash. You did not say pumpkin. Mm-hmm. We don't use pumpkin. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest if you're going to make your own pumpkin puree, do not use pumpkin. The can that you buy, the Libby, that's not pumpkin. That's butternut squash.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our number one secret is we roast our own squashes. You get a greater yield from butternut squash. The flavor is better. It's just a much yummier product. You'll notice if you try and roast an actual pumpkin, it's stringy and not delicious.
Yeah, the texture, I think, is also
can put that in the food processor. I've made many pumpkin pies from sugar pie pumpkins.
Sugar pie pumpkin is good. There's still a huge water content in there,
you
so you got to work
them.
To get the water mm-hmm. out of there. You just and you get more yield from that big, long neck of a butternut squash.
But let's just say mm-hmm. we're going to be truthful and make a pumpkin pie. That sugar pie pumpkin we're going to cut in half. We're going to take the mm-hmm. seeds out and the stringy, you know, the
junk.
The guts,
exactly.
For me, I do want them drier, so mm-hmm. I put them on a roasting pan and roast them in the oven until they caramelize a bit. And then when they're completely tender, I scoop them, put them in a food processor, puree them, and then I put them over cheesecloth for 24 hours mm-hmm. in the refrigerator.
And that's
exactly.
what we
used
to do.
Is that reasonable?
That's what we used to do, and that's why it took us so much longer
to
prepare.
Exactly how I do it.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's definitely 100% how you do it. If you use butternut squash, that's still how you do it. You mm-hmm. can just skip that draining step. There's not going to be any water that you need to lose there, especially
really?
If you
Nothing
roast it.
Out of butternut.
Not much.
Huh.
I mean, maybe we've tried it, and you'll maybe, if we have, like, a giant Lexan full. For mm-hmm. those who don't know, Lexan is like a giant container. You'll maybe get a cup of liquid out of there. So it's just,
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they're
and
much
what about
drier.
Things like Hubbard squash? You know, those are the big kind of wedges mm-hmm. that you see openly cut in the produce section. Mm-hmm. Those seem pretty dry to me.
I think that would be more like a butternut squash.
Okay.
They're less wet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's how we start. We start with our beautiful squash or pumpkin puree, and we make a butter out of it, meaning we whip maple syrup and soft butter into that. And so we have this, to begin, this unctuous, beautiful, velvety pumpkin butter. And from there, we then make a custard. It's like a creme anglaise, basically. And we've got our brown sugar and our spices and our eggs, and we temper that into that beautiful squash butter, and that's our pumpkin pie filling. And that alone has to sit overnight to get all the impurities to rise to the surface.
Just when you thought things were a little bit healthy, you have to go put butter in everything.
Pumpkin pie is still the healthiest pie,
just so
you know.
Wait.
Really?
Yeah.
I am so tired of hearing people say butter is not healthy. Butter is very healthy. Just don't eat the cow.
Well, it's super healthy if you're keto. I mean, I think you're supposed to
exactly.
just eat butter. But, yeah.
I mean, it's not butter is not unhealthy. It's people who are. Because they eat the whole pound in one meal. It's like... Would you drink a bottle of olive oil with your sandwich?
Absolutely.
No, you would not.
Everything is good in moderation, including moderation,
you know,
like Julia says.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to this pie. So we've got our filling.
So for our crust, Tom, you mentioned that beautiful ginger layer, and I think that really separates our pie from anyone
else. Okay, so we have a regular pie crust.
Regular pie crust.
Is it blind bake at that point?
No, first we make our ginger snap crumbs.
Okay, so tell me that.
So we use a speculoos cookie or a ginger snap cookie and just grind that up and add a little bit of butter, pinch of salt, and so we've got this really kind of a moist crumb.
Yeah, so we got more butter here, Chef.
This pie.
So a speculoos cookie is a paste cookie, right?
It's actually just a crispy ginger snap cookie.
Yeah, but you add butter, so it becomes a paste, right?
I wouldn't call it a paste. I would call it just as if you were... No, I would say the same texture as if you would for a graham cracker crumb. It'll clump together when you squeeze it with your fingers, but it's more of a crumb than a paste. So
Not quite a spread.
So we press that into our unbaked pie shell, and then we blind bake it.
That's why it looks like it's a paste to me, because it binds up with the...
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Right. So that I really think that's a very special part of our pumpkin pie.
Would you use Girl Scout cookie and crumble them? And
it's not Girl Scout season time, but maybe in March. That's a really cool trick for like a key lime pie or a lemon meringue, if you just want to, take it up a notch. So that's basically it. We take our pumpkin pie filling that we made with our pumpkin butter and our custard and our beautiful crust, and then we bake it low and slow. We're talking like 250 degrees in our ovens. So in a home oven, no higher than 300 degrees.
So the reason you're saying that is because you got to make sure it doesn't boil or get too hot.
Yeah, you're making a custard. Yeah, it's a custard pie. So it's similar to baking a creme brulee without the water bath or a cheesecake. You want it to slowly set.
So is that the only reason? I mean, one of the goals at the end of the bake is that you're... pumpkin, when it cools, doesn't crack.
Exactly.
Across it, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is that part of the low temperature?
That's part of the low temperature, yeah. And also our filling. I find that I get cracks a lot with pumpkin pie filling made without that step of doing the butter. There's something about that extra butter in the filling. A traditional pumpkin pie filling doesn't have a lot of butter in it, or if any. I think it's like a can of evaporated milk, a few eggs, and some Libby.
Right.
But that beautiful addition of the butter just sort of protects it. But if you do get a crack, that's what, whipped cream is for. And we do the ginger snap leaves on top as well as decoration. Yeah. Plunk a few on top of there. Nobody knows. Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to the... You can't just drop the ginger snap leaf.
Oh, you're right.
I had that this morning on my pie, and it was spectacular.
It's like a little...
It's like a dollop of butter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's that same cookie that we made the crumbs out of.
So that is more than a crumb. Oh, it's the same cookie that
you made. That's the same cookie we made. So we took those cookies, ground them up.
There's a lot of butter in that cookie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very light, crispy cookie, but it's buttery.
And then people always want to know when they have leftover pie, can it sit out on the counter? Does it have to go in the fridge? Pumpkin pie, I would say, with all the particular ingredients like the eggs and the milk and the cream, things like that, I would say into the fridge. What do you say?
I would say into the fridge. I actually like to eat it cold. Mm-hmm. To me, that it should be served cold. The pecan pies and apple pies you're going to eat, leave them on the counter.
But I think you're also right about if you want to avoid crack, make sure you let it cool off on the counter really well.
Oh, that's an excellent point. Yes. Once you've taken it out of the oven, let it cool to room temperature and then put it into the oven. Yeah. No more than 4 hours.
Right.
That's what the health department's going to tell you to.
Correct.
Let it.
But they don't care about cracks, so we're going to say
fine. That's true. Yeah.
You want to make sure your pie is cooled off enough so that it doesn't get brisk.
Well, yeah, and think about what it's doing to your refrigerator also if you put a hot pie in there, what it's doing to the rest of your things. Right. So, yeah.
All right, other pumpkin desserts.
Pumpkin bread, you mentioned, which I absolutely adore, and we have available in sort of a, we call them teen wolf size because it's Halloween. It's like a 1 pound size. It's not a giant loaf, but it's enough for two or three people. So we have those available. God, nothing could be easier than that. It's a quick bread. It's like making banana bread.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
Easy. Eggs, oil, pumpkin puree. This is when I bust out the can. It's, you know what I mean? The canned is fine.
It's also a place where you can use, if you're making pumpkin and you're living alone and you have a bigger squash, you use a quarter, you have a quarter of the squash left, you freeze it. Then the day Sunday you say, I'm going to make, pumpkin bread.
Yeah.
That's a
perfect.
Great way to use
perfect.
That.
Let's say you only have a cup of that and you need a cup of banana too to make your pie.
Yeah.
No problem. Banana, pumpkin bread. No,
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, the two, banana and pumpkin are very interchangeable. They behave very similarly. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if you guys heard, the dark days are coming. We've got like weeks of rain. So this is a really great time to just roast all your pumpkin right now and get your oven going.
Yep.
Stick it in your freezer till Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're going to roast pumpkins, roast a lot of it.
Yeah.
Put the puree in small container in the fridge and yeah. in the freezer. And
something that I like that you make over at the bakery are the pumpkin moon pies.
The whoopie pies. The whoopie pies. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
boy.
What's the process there? That seems...
It's kind of like a cupcake batter, only it's just people are crazy about, like, on September 30th, they're like, where's the whoopie pies? So, yeah, it's basically like a cupcake batter, a little thicker, a little more flour in it, so that it'll hold a scoop when you scoop it onto a sheet tray. So it's like a cross between a cookie and a cupcake mm-hmm. sandwich with cream cheese frosting. What more could you want?
And that is when you say it's a little thicker, you're just adding more flour, or what makes it thicker?
It's more flour.
More
yeah,
flour, okay.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Hmm, lovely. And then a little glaze.
A little sprinkling of pepitas, too. Spicy mm-hmm. pepitas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. Lovely. Well, thank you, Brittany Bartoleben.
Thank you.
I do believe there's a challenge on the table. Terry, I think she said something about wiping the floor with us.
No.
That's what I said.
She's whipping us out.
She's going to enjoy wiping the floor with us when
that's
it comes
right,
to our
right,
Food for Thought
right.
Tasty Trivia. So we're going to find out if she is
we'll see.
The great predictor.
Definitely stay tuned with us and wait for the end of that
game. For the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. To the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
I'm Brittany Bartoleben.
The chef from
the Dahlia Bakery.
All right, you're going to join us. And just so that we're clear with our, you know, our audience kind of comes and goes, mm-hmm. but I just want them to know that you have guaranteed to wipe the floor with Chef Terry and I today.
It is on record.
Oh, man.
All right. So let's get started here, Tina.
All right, here's how the game is played, you guys. You each get 5 questions. Whoever gets the most correct is obviously the winner. Whoever gets the least correct, though, it has to pony something up and give something precious away to someone who loves our radio show. And I know that Paula, who is in our audience today, really loves us.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
Also her birthday.
To you.
So if you lose, you'll need to give Paula a gift. Chef Brittany Bartoleben, what will you give to Paula?
We're going to do a $100 gift card to the Dahlia Bakery.
Nice.
We'll get you covered.
I thought you were
going
to give her 2 tickets to the kids' class.
No, it's supposed to be a present, not a...
not a punishment.
Not a punishment, exactly.
All right. Chef Thierry, what about
I'm
you?
I'm going to give lunch for brunch for two at Luc.
Nice.
How about that?
Paula, are you going to bring this nice young lady that brought you here today?
Absolutely.
There you go.
All right, Tom Douglas, what would you like to give Paula should you lose?
Well, Paula looks thrifty, so I'm going to give her a $10 gift card to the Dahlia Lounge. Which will get you a half a martini.
Yeah, someone is going to have to buy the rest of the glass.
You know, it's the Dahlia Lounge's 30th anniversary on November 15th, so we're going to do dinner for two at the Dahlia Lounge.
Dinner for two.
Which
all
is
right.
a $150 value.
Wonderful. These are all great gifts, so
Tom,
Paula
you need
will
to lose
definitely
today.
Win
That's
today.
What she's saying.
Yeah.
Very exciting. All right, who would like to go first?
I'll start.
Ooh, all righty.
There's a shocker.
Actually, we should get Brittany. No,
you want me to start?
No,
I'm sad. I want to throw away.
The first question's about flour, so you probably
you
don't
go.
Want Brittany
I'll
to start.
I'll stop.
all right, your first question, Chef Thierry. The main difference between all-purpose flour and bread flour is what? You have some options.
Go ahead.
All-purpose is exclusively unbleached, while bread flours come in a bleached and non-bleached variety. Bread flour has a longer shelf life than all-purpose. All-purpose flour has less protein than bread flour. Or does all-purpose flour have more calories per gram than bread flour?
Less protein.
You are correct. Good job. Thierry. Question number 2. How do you identify cilantro from parsley only by sight? Is it the leaf color? Because parsley has slightly orange tint when it's held up in the light. Is it the shape of the leaves? Cilantro has curvy, while parsley has pointy. Or is it the number of leaves? I know this is a really tough one for you. You got to count the number of leaves. So how do you know parsley from
I
cilantro?
I wish the people who are in their cars right now could actually speak, because I bet you there's 100 people going, what the heck is that?
Orange tint.
Who's never seen parsley? Cilantro. It's the shape of the leaf.
Correct. So it's trivia. Some are hard, some are easy.
If your parsley is yellow, you should return it and not buy it.
All right, Chef. Which of the following is not an example of emulsion? Vinaigrette, mayonnaise, chocolate, or red wine?
Red wine.
Correct. 3 out of 3 for you. All right, this is true or false. The dark meat of a chicken comes from muscles that metabolize less oxygen than the white meat cuts.
False.
You are correct. Whoa. Four in a row. Your last question. Which of the following wines is typically considered a full-bodied wine? Yep, that's your question. Syrah, Vino Verde, Pinot Grigio, or French Burgundy?
So you want to know which one is not or which one is?
The most full-bodied of those wines.
Syrah.
Yeah. That's 5 out of 5.
Whoa. Okay, Syrah, Syrah. Whatever will be, will be.
Brittany, your challenge.
Score,
the future is ours, honey. We'll see. Okay, Syrah.
Remember Syrah. That one time that you said you were going to wipe the floor?
I do remember. I'm not feeling good anymore.
All right. I have faith. I have faith.
Okay.
All right. When you dock pastry dough, what are you doing with this dough?
You're stabbing holes in the bottom
you
of it.
You most certainly are. There were actually... that was multiple choice.
Oh, no, no, I got that one.
I told you, Terry, we didn't have a chance.
Yeah, exactly. She's going to make 6 out of 5. You watch.
Another one that's really not fair. Royal icing is made with sugar and what?
Egg whites.
Damn. 2 for 2. All right. According to the Specialty Coffee Association beans classification, which of the following rating is highest? Premium grade, exchange grade, standard grade, or specialty grade coffee beans?
Specialty?
Yep.
Cool.
3 for 3. Great. Oh, this could be... Everybody could win today. We'll if you're making a savaroon, which of these ingredients is most present? Raisins, rum, chocolate, or gelatin?
A savaroon?
No, savaroon.
I'm sorry.
I can't pronounce it. Tell me
what the ingredients are again.
Raisins, rum, chocolate, or gelatin?
Rum.
How do you say it, Chef?
Savaroon.
Savaroon.
Rum.
Correct. 4 out of 4.
Also known as Rambabas.
Your last... I'm not giving you that one. It's okay. Too easy. True or false? Well, this is easy, too.
That's okay. Okay, it's fine.
True or false? Frangipani filling...
No, frangipan.
Frangipan.
Right. What is it?
Frangipan.
What's it contain?
Nuts, butter, and eggs, and sugar.
Does it contain almonds?
Nuts, yeah. Almond frangipan does.
Yep. 5 out of 5.
Cool.
You got this, Tom?
Oh, she's making fun of you now.
Wow. 5 is the number to beat today, Chef Tom Douglas. Tunneling is the appearance of large air bubbles that in muffins and quick breads. What is tunneling the result of? Is it adding too much butter fats, overmixing it? Not enough leveling agent, or is it overheated in the oven?
Chef?
I'm sipping my coffee.
All of the above. You should just try something else.
You clearly can't bake.
Or make it a toll road.
Do you actually...
Oven.
I'll say it's too hot of an oven.
Yeah.
It's actually overmixing.
Yep, there you go.
The answer to that one. Let's keep playing, though, because it's fun. Steak... Au poivre.
Steak au poivre.
Steak au poivre.
We got a language lesson and a cooking lesson.
Yeah, it's really fun. Steak au poivre typically has what done to it before cooking? Does it spend at least 20 to 40 minutes in the freezer? Does it go through an egg drench and then is coated with breadcrumbs?
That would be chicken fried steak.
It receives a coating of peppercorns, or it sits in a marinade in a porter beer and fresh lemons for at least 12 hours.
Wow, this is very creative. Did you write this?
Sean Tu wrote the quiz today.
No, it's got peppercorns on the outside.
Peppercorns is the answer. Good job. All right, question number 3. If you prepare something using the coddling cooking method, how are you cooking it?
Coddling cooking method?
Mm-hmm.
You're just giving it a quick... Drop in boiling water,
yep.
Simmering water.
That's the answer. Mm-hmm. True or false, par frying fries and then freezing them for at least 24 hours can extend their shelf life up to 3 months.
I've never tried it, so I can't answer that. I'll say yes.
Yep, that's the answer. Your last question, where does the heat of a chili pepper come from? Seeds, flesh, stem, or the pith?
I'll say the seeds.
pith is the answer. Pith Tom Douglas did not
That's
win.
That's a pithy response.
Tom Douglas did not win today, but Polisher did.
Polisher did, yep.
Dinner for two at the Delia.
Yay, $150 value. Happy birthday, Paula.
Happy birthday, Paula.
See, it pays to come to our show sometimes. This show is produced by the team at Large Media. That's including Sean Del Torre, or Don't Call Me Del Torre. Which is it, Sean?
Don't Call Me Del Torre.
Including Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre, Sean Tu, and Abigail Long, and Tina Noll at LARJ Media. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience like Paula, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. It includes breakfast and a hot cup of coffee. Also remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to your favorite podcast spot using Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.